Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 363, recorded August 17th, 2018, for September 7th, 2018. Ken Kashenda, Creative Selection. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Grammarly, the communication tool that helps improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for work, for school, and even on the go. It's a great way to double-check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly's premium today at grammarly.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to the most interesting minds working in technology today. I am Megan Maroney, and I am honored today to talk to Ken Kashenda. He was the principal engineer of iPhone software, worked for Apple for 15 years, and most recently, he's the author of Creative Selection, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs, which just came out.
It's coming out on September 4th.
So it just, right, this will be, it's September 4th right now?
September 4th.
September 4th.
Right, okay, great.
So it is available now at bookstores.
Right.
And you read the audiobook as well, right?
I did. About 2 weeks ago, I went in and 3 days at a recording studio at Stanford. Yeah, I read the audiobook. So hopefully that'll come out all right. I've heard a little bit. There's actually a clip posted online. If you've got show notes, we can maybe put the clip
excellent.
Of the introduction.
Awesome. So you have one of my favorite backgrounds of engineers. You went the liberal arts way. You were a history major at Yale, fixed motorcycles, taught in Japan. How did you get from there to Apple?
it's a roundabout course, yeah, for sure. Well, see, you know, I can pick it up from teaching English in Japan. Part of the reason that I went to Japan was to develop a portfolio of photographs. I was really interested in fine art photography at the time. It's what I spent a lot of time doing when I was at Yale. I spent a lot of time in the art department as well as the history department. And so my goal was to apply to get a Master of Fine Arts degree in photography and to teach. And so I went to Japan. I lived there for over 2 years and developed this portfolio of work and came back to the United States and attended Rochester Institute of Technology in New York. But see, the thing is, for some reason, I hadn't really maybe thought this out as well as I should, because my goal was to become a professor in a fine arts program. Well, it turns out that at RIT at the time, they had an opening on their faculty. And there were 800 applicants. And I did a little math, and I figured that, wow, boy, 2 years with my MFA, that's what the competitive landscape is going to be. And so I gave a hard think. And I was somewhat fortunate to be at RIT, which was not just an art school, but also a school of technology. And so right around that time, the printing industry was undergoing a big change, trying to bring computers more into the process. So I figured, well, I'll do digital prepress. I'll learn how to make photographs look good when they're printed. You know, it's an ink on paper sort of thing. And so I transferred out of the fine arts program into this printing technology program. But I only stayed there for one semester. So I did one semester in the fine arts program, one semester in the printing technology program. Because then, this was 1994, I discovered the web. It's like, okay, now I'm going to make photos show up on the web. And just one thing led to another. Started learning HTML and making websites. And so I transferred from the printing program to an information technology program. I just did a year, didn't get a degree, but I learned enough about the web to go get a job. And yeah, just one thing led to another.
So that was sort of the mid to late 90s were not the best years for Apple. But.
No, indeed. You know, and the thing is, I always had Macs. But for a little while there, I was working at a web technology company and I was doing some Java programming. And I actually changed out my Mac for a Windows NT machine. So for about a year, I was not using Macs every day. I still had one at home. Around that time, I had a G4Q. It wasn't the best time to be, sort of an Apple enthusiast at the time. So it was a bit of a low ebb.
And by the time you started at Apple, was Steve back?
Okay. So then that's jumping ahead, a number of years. So, so I rattled around a little bit, making websites and doing Java development, did a couple of startups and, eventually, a couple of startups of my own, which none of them really worked. And so the last startup was one called Easel, which was founded by Andy Hertzfeld. Bud Tribble was also a principal at the company, as was Mike Boych. And those three worked on the original Mac at Apple in the 80s. And so I joined the company to work with them. And so the idea of Easel was to make Linux on the desktop work. Well, that didn't work out so well. So once that company was finished, I haven't spoken to Bud about it, but I think what he did was, we had about 75 engineers. We did a round of layoffs, but there were a lot of really smart people. I think what Bud Tribble did was he called Steve on the phone and said, well, we're shutting down the company. We've got a number of really smart people working here. And Apple threw a job fair. So that was the first time that I was ever on the Cupertino campus, and I hired on, and there you go. So that was 2001.
Oh, wow. And you started as an engineer.
I started as an engineer, yes. And the day I started, the project that I started on was to develop Safari. I started with Don Melton, he was the manager, and I was his team. And the two of us set out trying to figure out how to make Apple a web browser.
It's so, until I read your book, I had forgotten that 2001 was the year that, or did it come out in 2002 or 2001?
So that project was about 18 months long. So the beta release of Safari at Macworld was in January 2003.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
So 15 years old.
It is, it's 15 years old now. And so to answer your question before, so now by that point, Steve had been back at Apple for around 4 years. So 96, 97. And so he was, I don't know if he's still technically the CEO. He was there at the time, but he was, firmly in control and set us that project, making the web browser. So we did.
So with your background, you have this amazing background in history and photography, and I know you worked on Safari, and you worked on the iPhone and the iPad and the Apple Watch. Did you ever have any involvement in the camera in the iPhone? The camera that obviously has really changed history, the history of photography that you had written about.
It's true. So the short answer is not back in that time. I did do some early prototyping for portrait mode. I was told that we were going to be Apple was going to be putting two cameras on the back of an upcoming iPhone, and so I got an early prototype and worked with a couple people in the design studio to try to figure out what to do. I came up with this idea. See, what happens is when the two cameras, what they do is they produce a depth map. And so it's basically a grayscale image, which you never see. But both cameras fire, and it creates this using just the parallax, the difference between the placement of the two cameras to figure out depth. And so it produces this grayscale image. I forget what it was. It's like, white is right against the lens and black is infinity. It's either that or the reverse, with grayscale in between. And so I did some early experiments to figure, what could you do with it? And so simulating depth of field was one thing. We did some other experiments, may not be coming out in the future. But that certainly came out, to try to simulate depth of field and give you some nice portrait effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. They yeah. are nice.
And some great people working the design studio on that. Johnny Manzari is one fellow mm-hmm. who's done still at Apple, I believe, and his name. He's actually done a couple of interviews. Apple's that let him speak. Publicly about the work on the camera and the photo effects, because I think he's just done great work. So it's great to see his name out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So going back another decade and then some, going back, you have a great section in the book about Richard Stallman, like just sort of, I mean, you introduce him, rightly so, to people, because some people might have not been familiar with his influence. And, you know, he was a name that everyone was throwing around in the early 2000s.
Sure.
So talk a little bit about what influence he had on you and the work that you did. And
well, he's had a tremendous influence on the entire computer industry. Mm-hmm. For sure. The whole notion of free software is, I think, one of, it is one of the foundations of the internet as we know it today, for sure. The Linux, of course, is the whole Linux development project is driven by the GPL, the General Public License, mm-hmm. which is really the fundamental notion that Richard Stallman came up with. It's this idea that that software should be free, and it's free as in freedom. That it's freedom as a that the software is free as a not only a technological good but as a social good. That a tremendous amount of intellectual effort goes into creating software, and if you begin to, as you know, as many companies do, of course, match up the profit motive with that software development, well, maybe the world isn't getting as much use of all of that intellectual effort as it might, and so. Stallman came up with this idea, and of course, he's lived his life by it. That mm-hmm. that you can devote your life to software, and as he has, and still somehow manage to put food on the table, mm-hmm. Support yourself, and part of the trick there is to figure out, well, how can you build a business around. Other perhaps ancillary services or other ways of generating revenue that is not directly tied to selling the software. Mm-hmm. So companies like Red Hat mm-hmm. to this day are doing this with Linux support contracts or big enterprise clients. Richard Stallman's a bit of a unique case in that he is famous as an advocate, but you look at Linus Torvalds himself, mm-hmm. right? He is the head of a huge free software project, and I think probably Linus is doing okay, and yet the world gets to benefit from the his intellectual output, mm-hmm. So for me personally, I went and I talk about in the book how Richard Stallman's influence and free software made me go and join a company like Easel that was mm-hmm. Attempting to create. A wonderful desktop Linux system for people. Unfortunately, the company didn't succeed, but one thing led to another, mm-hmm. and eventually we wound up using free software at Apple to make Safari.
Mm-hmm. And OS X as well. Like OS X was built on the Linux kernel. Am I remembering that wrong?
No. Okay. OS X is built on Mach.
Okay.
Which is software that that Avi Tavanian developed when he was, I believe he was a student at Carnegie Mellon, mm-hmm. and then that went and was the software infrastructure at Next.
Okay.
And then that so the Mach kernel. Is what forms the core of Mac OS X. Mm-hmm. But Mac OS X has a tremendous amount of free software mm-hmm. In it. Mm-hmm. Mac, the Mac ships with a whole host of free software projects. WebKit mm-hmm. is certainly an open source project. The printing architecture, there is the revision control mm-hmm. software. For many years, the compilers mm-hmm. Were free software, and on and on and on. There's a whole host of free software.
Mm-hmm. There are great illustrations. Now, remind me who did the illustrations in your book?
So, so there's a fellow named Guy Shield who is based in Australia, And I met him through a colleague. I decided that, well, gosh, boy, it would be great to get some graphics in there. I think of the illustrations as like film stills.
Uh-huh.
You know, as I try to do the best I can to set the scene in words, but there were some places that I thought it would be great to get, you know, an actual image to go along with it.
Well, here's the one of Richard Stallman.
Right.
Can we take a look at that, Karsten? And I just love it because he is the cashier at a candy store.
Right. And so, and as you can see, in the cash register is registering zeros because the software is free.
Right.
And so the idea of this, I don't know, you know, I'm a child of the 70s. And so the image in my mind for this photo comes from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So if you know the opening scene, they're in the candy store, right? And so, so you know, sort of inspired by that, sort of position Richard Stallman as the guy up at the front of the free software candy store, that the software is, you know, as a programmer, I look at the just the wealth of wonderful software that people spend their lives developing, and mm-hmm. then, you know, make it out, put it out there for free so that I can take advantage and then contribute my improvements back to the community. And that Richard Stallman is there, you know, having developed the whole notion of free software and the GPL, which keeps the whole software, free software mechanism going. And he's at the cash register making sure that everything works, right? Not there to take money, mm-hmm. but to make sure that the free software mechanics continue to work.
Mm-hmm.
$0, but the, you know, people contribute back in kind.
Right. So when you started at Apple, that you describe it as every day was like going to school. And you said that, you know, at the time, Apple was sort of the company where you might have used a Mac or, you know, an Apple computer in college. But, you know, once you got a real job, you were back to PCs. This sort of made me think it's like, you know, oh, I experimented in college, but now I'm...
Right.
So describe what it was like when you first started there.
Right. Well, Apple was a very different company. There were no iPods yet. So I started in June of 2001, and the iPod didn't come out for another 4 months. So the Mac was the company's only product. And so Apple was an underdog.
Mm-hmm.
The company's market share was below 5%. The industry was still dominated by Microsoft and Windows, the Wintel duopoly. And so... we were trying to figure out how to make ourselves relevant. Mac OS X had just come out mm-hmm. 3 months before, right? Again, the iPod wasn't out yet. So it was at this point where Apple was setting the stage for the success that we were going to try to make. But all of that was still in the future. So we felt like we were underdogs. I mean, you know, to even just give you a sense, so I started at Apple in 2001. In 2002, there was like a hiring and salary freeze,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you know, today, Apple, the trillion-dollar company,
yeah.
right? Seems like it has all the money in the world. But, you know, but back then, it was very, very different. We were underdogs.
Right. So the development of Safari... what was that like? Were there how long? You said it was. You started working in 2001 and mm-hmm. and launched in 2003.
Right. And so the goal we were set when Don Melton and I started was make a web browser, and I had never worked on one. So, well, how do you do that? Well, thankfully, I started working with Don, whose experience I also worked with him at Easel. And his experience before that was at Netscape. So he was involved in taking Mozilla from a closed source to an open source project. So Don had experience making web browsers. And so from the start, we set about saying, well, we're a two-person team. How are we going to make this huge project? And so Don had a plan that, well, we were going to go and survey the landscape, and one of the big ideas was to go and look for an open source project and leverage that and use just, you know, his effort and mine to try to get ourselves bootstrapped really, really quickly. you know, stand on the shoulders of the companies like Netscape with Mozilla, which mm-hmm. with their source code, and try to figure out if we could take that and make an Apple browser out of it. So that's how we started.
So at the time, there was Internet Explorer, but no Chrome at that point.
Right. No, there was Internet Explorer was the default browser on the Mac. And again, Mac OS X had shipped. So that was the browser. You know, it was, I think, Finder, Mail, Internet Explorer mm-hmm. were the three apps on the dock. And so our job was to replace Internet Explorer. And so, you know, we started with some open source ideas. And, yeah, we kind of ran into a couple of I ran into, a bit of a roadblock getting that going. And really, the breakthrough moment came about 6 weeks later. When the third person joined the team. So Don and I, during that first 6 weeks, you know, it sounds like it's a short amount of time, but we were expected to really get quick results. And we didn't really have any. We were looking at Mozilla. I was trying to get it to build on OS X. It didn't. We were looking at, Don was doing some negotiations with some closed source vendors to see if we could license their code. And we were struggling. We weren't really making any progress. And then the third person joined our team, Richard Williamson. And in 2 days, he had found, we had told him about our progress. He went out and found yet another open source project, KDE from the KDE browser, KHTML from the KDE project, which is another Linux desktop development, Linux desktop system, I should say. And he downloaded their browser, Conqueror, and made this incredible demo in 2 days and got it running. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the book, it was like Richard called us into his office. He set a crystal ball down on the desk, like waved his hand over it, and showed us the future. He just got this browser up and running, and he had it working on the Mac, and he was clicking links and surfing web pages. He had made a couple of shortcuts, but it was this amazing programming tour de force to just get this browser, you know, up and running. And it was like showing us the future. So we got started on that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I love about your book, it's not just a history of Apple, but it's also a great guide to a career, like what a career might look like. So after Safari, you had sort of a downtime. There were, you talk about this, there was a promotion that you didn't get. You thought of leaving. You went to interview at Google. You felt like you had a more fair interview process at Google.
Yeah, I did interview at Google. Yeah. They kept me there almost like 2 full days. Yeah, and it really put me through my paces. Yeah,
and sure. Offered you a job and asked you to
and
your
offered,
salary.
And offered me a job. It's kind of a funny story. So the Google recruiter calls me up. So I'm in my office at Apple. And I shut the door, and she actually offered me the job right over the phone and said, well, Ken, what kind of salary do you want? Which kind of seemed like, well, gosh, don't you want to invite me in? It's like, well, we'll talk about this. You know, she said, no, so Ken, I want you to go right now. She said, think big. For like salary and stock, it's just, well, I don't know. But it's like, actually, by that point, I'd already decided to stay at Apple. So I thanked her. I don't even know. I should have thought big, but I just wound up not doing it because by that point, I'd already decided to stay at Apple.
Yeah. Well, that's some bad. I feel like I've gotten that bad advice in my career. Well, if you don't want to do a job, just ask for like a ton of money.
Right. Well, you know, see, part of it is I've never looked, you know, my salary at Apple was good. I don't know what they were to offer at Google, but you know, beyond that, it was never really about the money. Mm-hmm. It was never about, you know, hey, can I parlay this into just, you know, making twice or three times. I have no idea what they would have offered, but it was really just more about the work. It was mm-hmm. more about just doing interesting work.
And you said that they recognize that at Apple, that you were more interested in projects than politics.
Right. Right. Well, see, the reason why I never thought big for the Google recruiter was in the meantime, I had a long conversation with Scott Forstall, mm-hmm. who was a couple of levels higher up in the management chain from me at that point. And he had heard that I was maybe thinking about leaving. I don't know how these things get around, but they did. And he and I had a long talk, and he just he wanted to find out what made me tick. And he discovered that I really liked projects. And so he said, "Okay, I think I've got maybe a project for you. It's going to take a couple of weeks to work it out. Just don't do anything. Stay here. I want you to stay. You're important to me. And so we'll get back together and talk about a project. But I mean, it was that personal touch that made the decision for me to stay at Apple. Yeah.
I do think so many people sort of get lost in that. Like they do, you know, I think many people are more interested in projects than politics, but then you seem like once you get a certain point in your career, like you have to start climbing up and then you're not doing what you love anymore.
Yeah, it's, I didn't do that.
It seems to have worked out.
I really didn't do that. I mean, in, you know, as I talk about in the book, I had one short stint at Apple for just a couple of months where I was a manager. But other than that, I was an individual contributor the whole time, just working on projects. Yeah, and trying to, every place has politics. Mm-hmm. I think Apple is remarkable for having as little of it as it does. Right? You know, it's... It's like one of those, you know, little cliches. It's right. You know, it's like, you know, you have one person, you know, as, you know, by himself, you know, it's two people, you can have a conversation, three people, you have politics. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, Apple, you know, is a very big company. And like I said, does a very good job at tamping that down, but it's inevitable that there is some of that. But there is a track, and I went along it for many years where I could just focus on doing the best work that I could.
And so was the next project the iPhone?
Well, I worked on Safari. I did HTML editing project for Safari, adding text editing to WebKit. And then I had this little break being a manager. And then after that, well, I mean, it's kind of a how I wound up not being a manager anymore. It's I discovered that I didn't like it as much. Mm-hmm. I missed programming every day. I wound up, having to worry about people more than code. And it was just something that I didn't take to. And so I just decided to get back to coding. And so I went to my manager at the time, Henri Lemureau, who I talk about in the book in a couple of different situations. This is certainly one of them. And I said, well, Henri, I don't want to be a manager anymore. I just want to do something else. And I was just adamant. And he was like, well, wait a minute. You took this management job just a couple months ago. But I was, put my foot down. And he's like, what are you talking about? You took on this other job. So he said, well, wait a minute. And he went away and talked with Scott. I went and talked to Scott. And they decide, a couple of days later, they were pretty miffed at me that I was just going to leave them in the lurch on this management role that I had just taken. But then they came, Henri came a couple of days after that, and he came in and he put a piece of paper down on the table between us. And he said, Ken, sign that. And it's like, well, what is it? Yeah, so I, it's a non-disclosure agreement. So I sign it, and he said, we're making a cell phone, and now you're on the project. It's called Purple, and now you're on it. And so then that's how I got started working on the iPhone. Yeah. I pushed my managers to the point where I had threatened to resign, and I had fully expected them to let me, and instead they gave me this terrific opportunity to work on kind of a dream project.
And so that you had no idea, or did you think that they were working
for
the rumors?
There was kind of like on the grapevine, but I didn't know. I really didn't know. I had heard that, maybe there was this, this big, important project going on, but I didn't know for sure. And so as I say in the book, it was part of my very bad negotiating when I told Henri that I wanted to work on a different project. Hey, if I can get it working on this super secret project that I've heard a little bit about, maybe I won't quit and go to Google and whatever. And he's like, what is with this guy? He just asked for one thing and we gave it to him. We made him a manager and now he's working, asking for something else. It's like, this guy's nuts. But they relented, thankfully. So very, very thankful to them for doing that.
And were there people also working on the iPad already at that time?
Yeah, well, you know, that's part of the lore that I only know second and third hand, mm-hmm. is that multi-touch originally, well, first of all, it started out as a project that they were laying out on tables with cameras pointed from above. I never saw that. But I know people firsthand, secondhand for me, but I know people who were working on that. And so the idea was maybe to use that as a tablet. But then a couple of key developments, key breakthroughs were made. One of them was inertial scrolling with rubber banding at the end. And the other was a springboard, you know, so an icon launcher. The lore that, you know, that I've heard is, you know, Steve saw those two things and said, you know, we can actually make a whole touchscreen system, mm-hmm. that you can have maybe a long list of contacts and you can scroll through them with this beautiful touch interface, touch one and make a phone call. It's like, we can do this. We can make a phone. And so that's when the iPad, you know, the tablet was put on the shelf and, attention was redirected into making a phone, and not long after that, that's when this NDA got put on the table in front of me. Within a couple of months after that, when I joined, they decided to hire some more people and start going on it in earnest.
And so you were the head of the team that the keyboard team.
I was head of the keyboard team. There was a keyboard team of one.
You.
So yes, I was the head of it. Yeah.
But tell the story about how you got to be the head of this team of one.
Right. Well, see, that part of the idea, what you need to know is that there were so few people working on software for what I would term the high level software, the user interface software. And I would term that as, you know, anything, you know, so from a technical standpoint, anything from core animation on up. And so everything from the low-level graphics, you know, everything that users can see and touch, apps, and then eventually the frameworks that developers were using. That's the team that I was on. And when I started, there were only six or eight of us. Mm. And people were joining a little bit, and so that was everything. That was apps. You know, we were working on Notes, we were working on Safari, and Springboard, and Mail, and Calendar, and so, I mean, there were more apps than there were people at the time, and so then there was also UIKit. And so even though that was not made for developers at that point, we were making UIKit for ourselves, frameworks. And so then there were system level features like the keyboard. And so there were two fellows working on that, but they had lots of other responsibilities on their plate as well. And so the way we worked is that, you know, everything was demos. We did very, very few paper mock-ups. We didn't draw on whiteboards. We made live demos of everything. And so what would happen is, at that point, gosh, like twice a week, Scott Forstall would lead a team, Henri, who was heading up the software engineers, and Greg Christie, who was heading up the human interface team, the HI team, as we called it, the small team of designers. And, you know, so probably about a dozen or 15 of us would go around in a little posse, visit engineers, either in their offices or the designers, you know, in their studio, and look at demos. And so one day there was a very difficult keyboard demo, where Scott was trying to type, and so we had these devices, and so I'll pick up a you know, an original iPhone here, because that's about the form factor of the device, and so the devices had a tether coming out of it like a 30-pin connector, mm-hmm. but it was actually not a 30-pin connector. It just kind of looked like one. Maybe the cable was a little bit thicker, and it was tethered to a board, a bare computer board that was sitting on your desk, and then that was connected by USB to a Mac. And this device that you'd hold in your hand was just a display screen, but it was touch sensitive. Mm. And with the Mac and the board and the display screen, we could get our software running, and you could hold it in your hand and use it. And so Scott had this keyboard demo in his hands, and it just wasn't working very well. And so he was trying to type and failing at it. And eventually he got to the point where he like held the screen up to his face and was trying to type an S to try to type his name, Scott. And he's like, he couldn't. He just couldn't. So he put the Wallaby down and we went over to the next demo. To the next office. And well, we didn't think anything of it. Sometimes demos went well and sometimes they went poorly. And, you know, everybody gave their feedback and whatever, and we just moved on. But a couple of days after that, Henri called everybody out, all the software engineers out into the hallway out of our offices. And he said, okay, everybody, stop what you're doing. Stop working on Safari. Stop working on Notes and Calendar and Spring Board every day. Stop. Everybody from right now is a keyboard engineer. Mm-hmm. Progress is too slow. We need to step up the attention on keyboards. So everybody just needs to start making prototypes of keyboards. And so we did. I went away and started making prototypes, and so did everybody else. And we went around and were showing them to each other informally as we did. That's just the way that we worked. So I would come up with an idea, show it to a teammate, and it was like, no, that's terrible, you know, throw it out. And but eventually the goal was, you know, through this, you know, this is good, this is terrible, you know, improving these demos. We were all pointing toward a big demo. We would take the ones that were more successful, and Scott would try them out. It'd be like a keyboard derby, as I call it in the book, where Scott would try them all out. And so he did. And I tell the story, I almost don't want to spoil it for readers, but eventually he picked mine as the winner. And so from that point, I became what's called in Apple speak the DRI, the directly responsible individual. I became the DRI for keyboards from that point. And so, yeah, I became the keyboard team. And everybody else went back to what they were doing. I mean, again, by that point, I mean, there's as many people as there were apps almost. And so, yeah, keyboards became my job, and everybody else resumed their regularly scheduled programming.
And so your keyboard, the way you describe it in the book, and I won't be too much of a spoiler, but it was like a telephone, sort of. Like each key had three letters, right? So it's how you used to spell words on the keyboard of your telephone.
Right. Well, the big challenge, I would say one of the biggest challenges for developing the touchscreen operating system as we did was, you know, as you're holding this device in your hands, and you have to remember, I mean, we all forget what the experience was like in that when you were aiming at a target on the touchscreen and you went at it with your finger, well, your finger is covering up the target that you're going for. Mm-hmm. And so now we somehow have confidence that, you know, we can just type away and the software will figure it out. But back then we always felt this twinge of apprehension. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, gosh, should I get the right thing? And that, you know, and again, you know, our software, you know, everything was in a prototype phase. Nothing really worked all that well. We were discovering how things should work. And so, you know, there was actually Richard Williamson who, as we were going through that development phase, when we were going from office to office, showing each other prototype keyboards, he just said, no, none of these small key keyboards are working. The keys need to be bigger. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to see them and tap them with confidence. And so, yeah, so we developed this idea that, well, if you just have, instead of 10 keys across, right, you know, QWERTY, right, you know, that maybe just have, say, 3 keys across or 4 keys across. So the keys are big. You can see them. You won't completely block them with your fingers, even if you have fat thumbs. And that, you know, somehow we'll write some software to figure out, well, which letter did you mean? on these multi-key keys. So yeah, I mean, their T9 was, you know, kind of an idea like mm-hmm. this. And so we experimented with that. And that was actually the keyboard that was picked as that Derby winner.
So there were a lot of people at the time, and I wonder if there were people inside Apple. I admit to being one of them. I always had Macs, and I loved them, but I felt attached to the mechanical keyboard, like the keyboard on my palm, the physical keyboard. Not that I do like mechanical keyboards right now, but you know, for my phone, I wanted the physical keyboard. Were there people inside that were just like, this is never going to work? People will never give up on the physical keyboard on their phone?
Well, the goal was to make people forget about their hardware keyboards. Mm-hmm. That was the goal. That was my goal. I think that was Steve's goal, because Steve saw that if we could make the keyboard software, it meant that we could take that part of the screen and give it to apps, so that when the keyboard isn't needed, right, it can just get out of the way. And you have a bitmap display, and we can show whatever we want with those other pixels. And so did we think that we could do that? Well, there were doubts. There were a lot of doubts. I mean, we called it kind of a science project, right? Kind of evoking, like gurgling test tubes and, you know, lab coats. And, we weren't sure that we could make it work, but it was a bet that we could.
Mm-hmm. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly has saved me so many times, and I consider myself a pretty good writer, but it has found things that I was just amazed that it found. Like sometimes I'll use a product name and it'll have a capital letter in the middle of it. And I didn't know that, and Grammarly knows that. It's really amazing. I should probably tell you what Grammarly is before I'm telling you how great it is. It's the communication tool that helps you improve your writing for every occasion. Grammarly helps you write more confidently, whether you're writing for work or for school or even on the go. They have a free version that'll help get you started. It's available across all platforms, including online, desktop, and your mobile device. Grammarly's premium version also allows users to track their writing skills and progress over time. We all love to track everything about ourselves. It's the quantified life these days. So why not track how much better Grammarly is making you at writing stuff? In addition to spelling and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps with advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, readability, and readability for all different kinds of occasions. So whatever you're writing for, if you're trying to write more casual, if you're trying to write more business-like, it knows, you can tell it what you want, and then it judges your grammar that way. And I say judge, but it doesn't really judge. It's not harsh. It's not like me if I were going to correct your grammar. It's nicer than that. 76% of surveyed premium users now find writing more enjoyable. So you probably want to know now how to get Grammarly. Hopefully I've convinced you. Grammarly.com/triangulation. You get 20% off Grammarly Premium today. That's Grammarly.com/triangulation. And we thank Grammarly for their support of Triangulation. So I want to talk about the specter of Newton. The Newton, if you're an Apple fan, you know the Newton was, I keep holding my hands like this, but it was probably around that size, right? It was
I brought props. You know, I should have brought my Newton. I didn't. Well, next time. Okay. Next time I'll have to come back and bring the Newton.
So it was the first handheld computer, I guess, or it was one of the first.
Certainly, an early one, yes. A PDA, right?
And then so part of why it failed was the text input. And so you talk about in the book how you were sort of all living under that, well, if this fails, the whole project's going to fail, so we better make
right
text input.
Well, I mean, I think if people remember the Newton today, they remember it for its faulty handwriting recognition, mm-hmm. right? And part of the, you know, it's like the Newton never. Oh, so we have Newtons. Yes. Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
A bit
right.
Dusty. But,
yeah. It's dusty. Well, there you go. Right. Well, this is marvelous. I mean, this is actually great. I mean, it's you know, part of the reason why I brought these along. How can we get these on here so we can see? Just to get the form factor difference. It's actually great to see the Newton down there with the iPods and the phones and the iPads. Wonderful. And so the idea, of course, is that the the Newton is that you just pick out the stylus, and you open the display, and you would use handwriting to write on
actual handwriting.
Actual handwriting, and that the device would recognize your handwriting and turn it into text. It didn't work. Now the thing about it is that, the Newton was not a successful mass market device. However, the faultiness of the handwriting recognition did break through into sort of mass market consciousness. In the book, I actually reproduce one of the sort of famous Doonesbury cartoons at the time. Is that it was well known enough that the Newton couldn't understand what you wrote, that this could be a joke that people would see in the funnies, in comic strips. And so this was the specter of that sort of hung over us, especially with every bad demo that we had while we were developing, while I was developing the software for this thing, for the first iPhone, people were just saying, oh man, it's going to be another Newton. Mm-hmm. The rest of the device is going to be wonderful. Then there were wonderful qualities with the Newton, perhaps the same for the iPhone, is that they're going to be, it's going to be a breakthrough, right? This touch operating system, but it's going to fail because people can't enter text into it. Mm. So that was the worry.
Right, because the iPod was a success by then.
A huge success.
But there was no text required. There was no text.
Right. Right. Of course, then the click wheel was this this wonderful breakthrough in input methods, right, that made the device, made 1,000 songs in your pocket seem like easy to work with. Mm-hmm. Right, it's just that navigating through the window with the little side to side menu interface in the little window and the big click wheel below the menu button to go back and then the media controls, it just worked for people. Mm-hmm. Right, and so that was our dream for the iPhone, is that people should be able to just pick it up and use it and not have to pull their hair out.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this was long before Siri. There was no asking to find anything.
Oh no! So of course, the iPhone came out in 2007, and Siri was 2010, 2011. Yeah, so it was years later. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about when the launch of the iPhone.
Sure.
You have a great story, a great Bill Atkinson story. Bill, who's been on this show and many, and Leo's interviewed him several times. So you went when it finally launched. Tell us what you did on the day.
So of course the iPhone was announced in January of 2007, but we couldn't sell them right away. There were some regulatory hurdles and things like that. So Apple announced the product months before they were before it would be available. So then, finally, 6 months later, in June of 2007, they were finally going to be available for people to buy in stores. And so on that day, I didn't go to the office as I usually do. I'm a morning person, so I wake up early, and I get to the office around 8 a.m. or whatever. Well, I didn't do that on launch day. So instead, I hung around at home a little bit later than usual. And then I got in my car and drove from Sunnyvale, from my house, to Palo Alto, where there was an Apple store. So I parked the car, and there was already this big line of people. Mm-hmm. Snaking around the corner. And so I parked my car, and I go, and I start walking the line. And so I get about halfway down the block, and I see in the distance there's like some guy's got a little clutch of people around him, and he's waving his arms around. And so I get a little closer, and I recognize him, and it's Bill Atkinson. And sort of for people who don't know, or I'd say Bill Atkinson was one of the key developers on the original Mac. He developed Mac Paint and HyperCard. I mean, the man is a legend. He's a hero of mine. So I see him. I recognize him. But he and I had never met. And so I just go in and join this little clutch of people. And so Bill is has got something in his hands. I mean, he's, you know, and again, he's just, I don't know if you, Bill, he's very, very animated. He's very, very excited. He's just full of energy, full of enthusiasm for everything. And so I asked him, this is a Bill, what is that thing that you're holding? Because it looked like an iPhone. And he said, but it couldn't have been because they weren't on sale yet. And he had left Apple years ago, so there's no way that he could have gotten one, you know. And so he showed it to me, and it was this model of a wooden iPhone. So he said he was so excited about the product, and he wanted one like so much that he couldn't wait. And so he has like, you know, like a shop. I don't know if he got CNC machines or, you know, things like that. I mean, he's, you know, he is, you know, he's a genius, you know, so, you know, thankfully he uses his powers for good. And so he's got this, you know, this shop at home. And so he milled out, you know, a perfect model of an iPhone and then pasted on this, you know, this photo of the clownfish that was used in the, you know, the original marketing, just so that he could hold it. Before, you know, see, he made himself a toy iPhone, right? Just so he could hold it. And so I'm standing there just like, you know, like marveling, you know, at, you know, being there with Bill, you know, and it just seemed to me like this wonderful connection of, you know, sort of old Apple and new Apple. Mm. And so, you know, I thanked Bill. And, you know, said, Bill's great. I hope you enjoy your iPhone when you get it, when you get to the head of the line. And I got back in my car and I drove back to the Apple campus.
I presume you already had your iPhone at that point.
I didn't bring it. I didn't bring it. I was right around that time. It was actually shortly after the announcement that I started having a late stage prototype. So I had one, but I didn't bring it to the mm-hmm. to the store.
So what happens on that day? You go back to the work and then
right.
So iOS 2 or
Well, the first thing that happened was I. You know, I had, you know, kind of like, you know, stars in my eyes. I just met one of my heroes and, you know, seeing him online there buy his first iPhone. So I get back to campus and I badge into the hallway and Scott Forstall was out in the hallway, which is very rare. He was just always so busy and he was not somebody to hang out, but he was hanging out in the hallway. And so I was like, Scott, and he just like, you know, pours a glass of champagne and hands it to me. And we toasted the iPhone. So that was a pretty nice treat too. And so after that, we got back to work.
So you write a lot about the demo culture, which is so, I mean, we don't know a lot about this. You're not at Apple anymore, so you're allowed to talk about it. But I mean, what is it like? I mean, you demoed for Steve.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, to ask the question, it's like, you know, what is the design culture at Apple. It's like you turn over so many of these, you know, Apple products, it says designed by Apple in California. It's like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that the demo culture is the most concise definition that begins to explain what it is. How do we design things at Apple in California? Well, we have this demo culture, and it's certainly something that we used to design the software for the first iPhone and many of the products that I worked on, you know, here at the table, iPad and so forth. And what that is that you make a demo. The demo represents the stage of the product that you're at. It is the best estimation of the product, the final product that you can make, given where you are in the stage of the project. Early stage demos, sometimes they're just screenshots that are animated together with touch. Again, we were trying to figure out so much with the touchscreen operating system. When an app goes side to side and then you hit the back button, well, how fast should that animation be? Mm-hmm. We made a demo. We made a back button. And we tested out different animation speeds. Should it be 350 milliseconds? How about 300? Would that be better? I don't know. So we made a demo. And so we created these prototypes that were as much like the final experience as we could. And that's how we went from an idea to a final product.
So you talk about the seven elements of success, to success at Apple.
Yeah.
Inspiration, collaboration, craft, diligence, decisiveness, taste, and empathy.
Empathy. Yeah.
I thought that I really thought that was a great list. Just, you know, not necessarily for getting a job at Apple or thinking you want to get it, but just for, you know, what people might think of in their career, like how do they want to do their work, whatever it is, engineering, or talk a little bit about those seven elements.
Yeah. Well, see, this is after I left Apple and decided to write this book, I wanted to think back and say more about, you know, what was the development culture like? I mean, these seven elements is one of the things that I came up with. I tried to think about what did we do every day? If I wanted to distill down, I mean, it's like, well, like lots of other places, we had lots of demos. We had meetings. We went to lunch and we talked about the work, right? I spent long, long hours sitting in my office, staring at a screen, writing code. And so to go down to a level deeper than that, to try to figure out, well, what's in common with all of those things? So if I wanted to think about, well, a good demo, well, what were the elements that went into making that good demo? Maybe when we really decided finally on what the proper animation speed for that back button was, well, what went into that? Well, taste went into it. I think craft went into it. The animation is just not a linear animation. You know, there's an ease in and ease out. There's some craft and taste associated with that. But yeah, there's also empathy, which, you know, I define as, trying to, you know, put yourself in other people's perspective, right? And then creating the work that fits people and adapts to their needs, right? Becomes intuitive for them so that the work explains itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so trying to, you know, as a product designer, trying to think about, you know, other people's experiences is a huge part of what went into these products.
So we got some questions from Twitter. You asked on Twitter for questions. I asked for questions on Twitter. One person asked you, "How did the designers collaborate with one another? Did they use Photoshop? How did you guys collaborate?"
Yeah, I mean, demos is really the best way to explain that. But just to really speak to that a little bit more specifically, the designers. Okay, so there were really two development teams that made the software, say, for the original iPhone, the original iPad. There's a software engineering team and a team of human interface designers, HI designers, as we called it. And their job was... Yeah, I mean, their job was empathy more than anything else, right? Human interface, right? It's right in the name. And so, yeah, they would do work in Photoshop. Sometimes they would send me a Photoshop document or even just a small Photoshop file for a button. And very, very quickly, then it was my job to take that and put that into a demo so that we could get it on a screen, right, and start tapping it, right, and start seeing how it moves on the screen, how it looks with all of, if it's a button, how it looks with, how it families. It's just like one of the things that we said all the time. How does that button family with all of the other user interface elements? You know, if we change the shade of blue by 2%, how does that work? So, yeah, we did use Photoshop, but it was never really like flats of whole screens. I would get that and then very, very quickly chop that up and get a demo on a device so we could see how it looked as you were holding it in your hand and moving. Yeah.
The amount of thought that goes into these products. I mean, before, one of the first questions I asked you was, you know, what did you do on the Apple Watch? Because that was your last project. And you pointed out that it was your job to do the colon on the time.
Yeah.
And when I really looked at it, it does have a very... I hate to use the word delightful, but it is delightful the way it flashes.
Well, I mean, so the job there was, well, in digital times, we wanted the colon to blink once a second, right? And so, it came to me to figure out, well, how should it blink? You know, what is the exact character of it? And you know, it actually, you know, since you know, many of the animations, we try to get them to run at 60 frames per second. I had 60 frames to play with, right? So I just broke it down and worked with a couple of designers, and we went back and forth. There was this long process of just lovingly crafting those 60 frames. So look at the colon blink on your digital time if you have an Apple Watch. I mean, it was lovingly crafted, right? Crafted with taste and with empathy.
And family.
And to have it just be one of those things that hopefully just feels right.
Right, yeah.
That you don't need to notice it, right? It was the effort that we put into it that just seems right and great. And so that if you don't notice it, you know, but then if you do look at it and it's success, great. I consider that a success.
Someone else asked, what aspects of the design do you regret?
Well, you know, there are no real regrets. No real regrets.
No regrets.
You know, I did the best I could. And I know that all of my colleagues did as well. I mean, but to give an answer to the question is, I'm sorry that it took so long to get copy paste, you know, on the iPhone. I mean, it was my job to do not only the keyboard but the whole text system. So the the loop that the little magnifying loop that comes up above your finger to place the insertion point was in the first version of the software, but I simply didn't have time to do keyboard and autocorrection and develop the dictionary and do the text multi-line text text areas for notes and text fields for the contact cards, and then year two we did the developer APIs, and so it just took a long time to get around to cut, copy, paste. So, I mean, I wish we could have gone faster, but
it wasn't like you hadn't thought about it. It was.
but interestingly, and so that's one of the other essential elements that I talk about is decisiveness. Mm-hmm. Is that I did not work on it in those first 2 years or in the development phase before that, starting from 2005. I did not work on text selection or cut, copy, paste. We just decided that no, that was going to have to be later. Mm-hmm. And so we spent all of our time working on the things that we did ship.
Mm-hmm. I guess there was a question about UI scroll view. Do you remember what the question was? All I wrote down was UI scroll.
Yeah, because UI scroll view is a piece of the developer frameworks that delivers by default, developers, third-party developers, and also Apple internal developers can take that component and put it in their apps to get that beautiful inertial scrolling. So you have a list of items in your app, whatever it is, a list of songs, a list of contacts, a list of calendar events, whatever it is, mail messages, or whatever third-party developer might have. But that behavior is the same because all developers are using UI scroll view. And so the question from Twitter was, what was the team that developed it? And the funny thing is, again, there was one engineer working on it, and pretty much, one designer. But again, there was a lot of collaboration, of people, again, lovingly crafted that slow down and that rubber banding. How much should it rubber band? There was a tremendous amount of effort that was devoted to that, to get it right for that first release of the iPhone. I mean, I can't tell you many, many, many hours, days, weeks, months.
What changed between, this is another question from Twitter, what changed between iOS 1 and iOS 2?
I'm going to answer that in a slightly different way. I can give a quick answer. What changed between iOS 1 and 2 was we made the developer API, right? So, it's like one of the things is like the widget in Notes, was deemed not good enough. So it was actually rewritten. So I had written the original one that was used in Notes, and then a one that was good enough for third party developers was made from scratch by, a better framework developer than me. So let me answer this question in another way, is that on stage, apps like Stocks and Weather were web apps. And so between the time of the announcement that Steve, you know, held up the first iPhone for everybody to see, and the first customer shipments, they were rewritten in Objective-C, mm-hmm. you know, in code rather than as a web app. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of like one of those things that they were deemed not good enough, the performance wasn't good enough, and so people just you know, put their nose to the grindstone and rewrote them as native apps for that first release.
So Brian Merchant wrote The One Device about the creation of the iPhone, and you haven't read it, as good writers do. They don't want to read similar books.
I was, as I said to you off camera beforehand, yeah. I was in the midst of writing my book. So I just didn't, I was expecting it to be good. So, you know, I just didn't like want to have that in my mind. Yes.
But one of the things he talks a lot about is how the people working on the iPhone just like nearly killed themselves, ruined marriages. Like they were just worked so hard. I don't get that in your book.
Right.
Was that your experience?
It was not my experience. I always looked at work as a marathon, not a sprint. And that, I try to keep very regular hours. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of stress. And I talk about in the book the one time, yes, I did lose my temper one day and shouted at somebody to get the whatever out of my office.
Just one day?
Yeah, just one day. Well, I try not to lose my temper. But yeah, it did boil over sometimes, yes. But, you know, I figured that the way to prevent that from happening more often was to just keep regular hours. Mm. Now, of course, I would go home and I'd be up, you know, at night looking at the ceiling, thinking about work. And part of it was just a coping mechanism to try to just keep hours under control. I mean, I don't really know how other people did it. Some, as you know, as Brian Merchant, you know, talked about, some marriages got wrecked. I don't know if that was so much in the software organization. Mm-hmm. But, I talk about software development in my book, but obviously there was, you know, hardware development and, you know, there's people, you know, doing the marketing and the industrial design and then the radios and trying to get, you know, ramp up manufacturing, supply chain. I mean, there's a tremendous amount that goes into making a product like this. But in the software organization, I think for the most part, we managed to keep a lid on the pressure cooker.
And how about those demos? Did you have to, did you go in with a thick skin? Like, I know you described some situations where it's kind of like, oh, that doesn't, you know, we don't like
that.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. People, demos, see, another real aspect of the demo culture, which I should be clear to talk about, is that the feedback was always very frank. Very, very frank, especially with Steve. But not only with him. I mean, this part of the idea is, and I talk about a couple of demos that I gave to Steve in the book, to give that flavor. But a part of it is to give that flavor, but then to also give the sense that Steve created the model for all of the other demos that we did every day, mm-hmm. or with Scott periodically, you know, every week or, you know, week or so. So this very, very frank, very, very straightforward feedback of what people like, what they don't, what are the strong aspects of the work, why an aspect is strong. Not that I like something, I don't like something, but why we liked it, why we think an aspect of work is strong, or correspondingly, whether a piece of work is weak. And so it's that frank feedback that kind of keeps the demo process going. And it's the reason that I called the book Creative Selection. It's this long evolutionary process of creativity to just building on the strong aspects of the work, keeping those, discarding the weak, and just, you know, going and going and going. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But all the feedback has to be very, very frank in order for that to happen.
This is more of a technical question. Well, not really technical. Why not a row of numbers on the keyboard? This is what Al asked on Twitter. And I have to press the number keys or swipe with various success to produce something as simple as a phone number.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, well, I think that's an interesting question. It's like, I apologize, if you need to, enter in a phone number in the middle of regular text. Mm-hmm. But one of the ideas that I came up with, and it was available even in the first iPhone, was the idea that a text field can tell the keyboard what kind of data it contains. Mm. So that if you went into the Contacts app, for instance, and just went through it, when you enter in the person's name, you'll get the alphanumeric. You'll get the alphanumeric keyboard. But when you go to their phone number, it'll change to a number pad. When you go to enter in the state abbreviation, the keyboard will go to all caps. Mm. So, and that this little hint can be provided by the developer to tell the keyboard what kind of data is going to be entered, so the keyboard can customize itself. Try to be a little bit empathetic. Mm-hmm. Again, but the keyboard was just too small to have numbers the whole time. And so the last thing that I would say about that is that we thought about the trade-off of, do we take up more screen real estate to add yet another row on top? And correspondingly, on this, original phone, do we take up, one more row and thereby diminish the amount of screen real estate available for the content? So it's kind of a long answer, but I just kind of give you the idea that we thought about it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny when you say, I've never noticed that about the entering the, the all caps and the state and the number. And it's like there are negative bias, right? We only notice when something doesn't do right. What we want it to do. We don't notice right. When it does what we want it to do.
Right. Well, I mean, to me, that is a hugely important aspect of product development, is that as much as possible, you want people to be delighted by the product. You want people to have positive experiences. But at the same time, you want to prevent negative experiences, mm-hmm. and that it can't be an even trade-off. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I have one good experience mm-hmm. and one negative experience, so they cancel out. No, that's mm-hmm. not how it works. You need to have, my mind is 99 positive experiences to counterbalance the one negative one. I mean, I want that the chips to be stacked as high as possible on the positive side, so that, yes, when sometimes the gears do grind a little bit, that it's so infrequent, as infrequent as possible, that people just, still wind up having a smile on their face.
Right. I think we have a question in our chat room about how many hours a day was your average work day?
I try to keep it, around 9, 10 was not uncommon. Longer than that is no good. Yeah. I mean, your brain turns to mush after mm-hmm. a while. I mean, especially since the majority of my days was writing code, mm-hmm. sitting, looking at, a screen of text and trying to figure out how to make the software do something different than what it was doing. And after a certain point, I was 40 years old. I wasn't 20 years old mm-hmm. when I was working on the iPhone. I was 40 years old. At a certain point, you have to take care of your brain. Otherwise, you will not be able to keep up the marathon.
Were most of your team around your age, or were they younger?
There were a lot of people right around my age. Yeah. Richard Williamson mm-hmm. was born within a couple of months of me. Mm-hmm. Henri Lemireau, our manager, was even just a couple of years older. Scott Forstall's a couple of years younger. Mm-hmm. Greg Christie, who was running the human interface team, right around my age as well. There was mm-hmm. a variety of people right in that age group. And younger, there were a couple of people younger working on the iPhone. But I would say, I was maybe close to the average age, oddly enough.
Mm-hmm. Another question from Twitter. Did you test iPhone interaction concepts with users? Scrolling inertia, chessboard patterns, back button, etc. And how did user research or testing affect what you made?
Okay, so in a way, I was lucky in my career. in that did I test products with users? Yes. And the users were the people around me. Yeah, see, you know, part of the difficulty was that we were developing these products in such secrecy. Mm-hmm. But the advantage was that the products were for us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, and so to provide a contrast, it's not like I was developing a piece of medical equipment mm-hmm. where a doctor was the user, right? Where it needs to now do what the doctor is, make sense to the doctor, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not a doctor. So how do I figure out what is going to make sense to the real user of the product? And so we tried to make the products for everybody. And so we were lucky in that regard, so that I could come up with a prototype, a demo, and show it to the person in the next office. And we were the target audience. Mm-hmm. We were the one who wanted this wonderful iPhone. We wanted to take our cell phones that we had and throw them away mm-hmm. and make something better. So yeah, did we test products with users? Yes. I mean, I understand that this is a kind of a little bit of a snarky answer, but that's how we thought about it. And that's again why empathy was such an important part of the development process. And to just say one more thing about that is that we worked with the accessibility team at Apple to make sure that the product would work with people who need assistance to see or need assistance to hear or need assistance with touch. Maybe their hands aren't as steady as they used to be. And so we had, it was a huge team of incredibly talented people at Apple who focus on accessibility. And we, that's, again, do we work with users? Yes. You can hand the phone to people who need to have the font be 120 points in order to see it. So, yeah, we did.
Do you remember something that was changed after with input from the accessibility team?
Oh, absolutely. So now this is skipping ahead to many, many later versions. But one of the things that changed in iOS 7 was a lot of the user interface elements changed from blue to white. Mm-hmm. Right, the blue background became a white background, mm-hmm. and so the screen, on average, became brighter. And some people have a real sensitivity to brightness, mm-hmm. right? And so they couldn't look at the screen. I mean, it's almost like, here I am looking at some of the lights here, and they're a little bit too bright. So what am I going to do? I'm going to squint. It's a little not comfortable to stare at directly. And so some people had that with just the brightness level on the screen. And so for iOS 8, one of the projects that I did was I worked with the accessibility team to add in a control that would take the overall brightness level of the screen, change the gamma of the display so that just changing the curve so that black stayed black, but that white just wasn't going to be as bright, mm-hmm. that we just added a little bit of a change in the curve so that white was only 95% as white. And the people on the accessibility team said, and that they then reached out to people in their community, said, yeah, this is going to work for us. And this kind of work happens.
I'm going to ask one more question because I know we've been talking for a long time. Ed asked, how do you recognize a trade-off between form and function? And if so, how do you adjudicate it? It feels like Apple often favors form over function and makes us adapt rather than adapt to us.
Okay. So I can certainly speak for the time that I was at Apple, and I can give an answer which then people can maybe find even more examples about in my book. So I talk about working around the years, around the time of the iPhone. And so my answer to that is design is how it works. That is my philosophy, and it's not just mine. I mean, this is something that came directly from Steve. Mm-hmm. It's probably my favorite thing that I ever heard Steve say. It was actually in an article published in the New York Times where Steve was talking about the iPod. And Steve said something to the effect of, people think that design is, well, you give the designers a box and, the brief is just make this thing look good. And that's not how we work. Design is how it works. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully in the conversation you hear, and hopefully if you get the book and read it, that you'll hear that, that to me, the form needs to follow the function, you know, which again even sounds funny when it comes to pixels on a screen, is that the device should tell you how to use it. It's eventually why we chose a QWERTY keyboard, mm-hmm. because it was the most obvious, right? We tried, as I talk about in the book, many different designs that weren't the most obvious thing. And so to me, design is how it works. How do we adjudicate that? Well, you know, again, we were the users for these products, you know, so... To me, it is one of the most important threads that runs through the work that I did in my career was to be empathetic and to have it be design is how it works.
Well, there's so much more in this book. I could talk for the next 3 hours with you or more. But we have not spoiled the good meat of the book. There's so many. There's a lovely story of your last demo with Steve in here. There's so many more interesting, like, trial and error stories. Creative selection, Ken Kashenda, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs, is available now. Unless you're watching this live, then it's available for pre-order now. You can also get the audiobook. You can get it on Kindle. You can get it in your local bookstore. It's a great book and highly recommend it. Ken Kashenda, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for having me. And thank you for watching Triangulation. Triangulation records every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. And you can join us live usually, or you can download it. You can watch or you can listen. It's wherever you get your podcasts. You can get it. We'd love for you to subscribe. Go to twit.tv/try to find out all the ways you can subscribe. I am Megan Maroney, and we'll see you next week.